Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. As always, I am your host, Reggie Darden, and I am very excited to have Mr. John Sepulveda with me today, and we're going to talk Kenpo, talk martial arts, and whatever other items that we get onto. I start things off usually with giving my background in that I'm training in five different martial arts at this point. And yeah, so I stay pretty busy with things, but try and make it all work. So let's get things over to my esteemed guest here. So since Mr. Sepulveda is very well known in the Kenpo circles and the martial arts circles, I'm gonna kind of change things a little bit here and. I don't think we're going to want to spend too much time on his, you know, kind of where it all started, because I think that's been covered quite a bit. But we will go ahead and touch on that and then move into some other items. So let's just, you know, kick it off as I usually do in that where did Kenpo find you? Where did it all start? And we'll just kind of... I guess maybe give the Cliff Notes version of that, and then we'll move on to other items. So,
okay. Well, first, thanks for having me on. Finally making it happen here. So, I got started in 1964, and a buddy of mine that was looking into going into the military wanted someone to go in partners with them on taking a couple of private lessons to try it out first. And so at the time, I think it was $20 for five private lessons. So 10 bucks each. So we managed to get 10 bucks each, you know, put together. And he had a car. I wasn't driving quite yet. And we started off. It was in San Jose, California. And after the first lesson, I was hooked. It didn't work for him. And he let me know that he wasn't going to continue. And so I got the rest of the four private lessons to myself and never turned back, which is something that struck a chord with me. And like I said, I haven't turned back since.
Yeah, that's something that I always find funny with a lot of my guests. We have people that have kind of, you know, made the martial arts their life, and they've, you know, excel to these upper levels. And many of them either didn't want to start, didn't even want to get into it. They just, you know, kind of got into it by accident, or similar to you, joined with a friend and they stuck, the friend took off and the guests stick around. So I always kind of find that funny and interesting, and that, Kenpo kind of chose you instead of you choosing it so much.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, that's very interesting that Moore had the same experience. I hadn't heard that before, but
yeah, it's come up quite a few times. It's definitely come up more than I would have expected. I mean, for me,
yeah.
I've always been into them, always been excited about the martial arts and always wanted to do it. And it was just kind of right from the get-go. That was something that I wanted, but yeah, many people, they just stumbled onto it or they weren't interested and just kind of went from there. So, what would you say was the thing that got you hooked? What did you see, that really brought you in?
I liked the discipline aspect of the thing, and it was an individual type of, I think, I won't say sport at the time because I didn't realize it at the time, but just an individual effort. Yeah, there was other people in the class and stuff like that as we progressed, but it was just an individual effort, something I can get out there and do by myself. I didn't have to be a team member, so to speak. You know, with nine other guys or five other guys on a team, you know, which I did. I did play baseball. I did play football. I did some wrestling, you know, but like I said, this was more of an individual efforts, you know, that I can put into it. And I felt as much as I put into it, I was getting out of it. So it just really hooked me.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Now, we'll apologize. We may kind of jump around a bit here, but I wanted to get to the teaching side of it. When did the teaching side of it get to you? And was that something that you were always interested in?
No, I wasn't interested in it at the time. You know, I think when I became a green belt, I was asked to, you know, assist in some of the classes and such like that, like, you know, most others have as well. But I remember being approached by an old timer back then, actually, J.T. Will, who was another very, very famous name, came to me and asked me if I was interested in going with him to Cleveland, Ohio. And I, at the time, I'd never been out of the state of California. And I'm sitting there thinking, Cleveland, Ohio, oh, geez, you know, what's the weather like back there? Because I didn't really know. And then, you know, looking up logistics like that, I'm just thinking, no, I don't think that's going to be for me. You know, he tried for several months to get me to come out, but it just didn't work. And in the meantime, I get my brown belt and was asked to go teach at another school in Stockton, California. And at the time, I thought, you know, okay, what's the logistics here? So I looked that up and found that I had some friends living over in that area that were in martial arts. And then I would be managing the school. And the pay was pretty good. You know, the hours were long, but I didn't mind the hours because I enjoyed what I did. So I took that job and lasted there about 2 years. But it was a full-time job. So I worked from 9 to 9, Monday through Friday, and then from 9 to 3 on Saturdays. So took a lot of my time, but like I said, I enjoyed it and just something I got hooked on.
Very nice. Yeah. Also, you know, like with starting the journey, there's been a number of guests that weren't interested in the teaching part of it and just kind of got thrust into it and then just kind of ran from there. So seems to be a very common thing, not only in just Kenpo, but in the martial arts in general. So that's kind of fun to see that many of us are connected in that way. So since you're at the top of the food chain here, and I'm curious as to kind of what your perspective is, having been a part of Kenpo for as long as you have, what is just kind of your maybe perspective on just the direction that Kenpo is going in? Where would you like to see it go? You know, of course we don't want to get into any kind of drama or anything like that, but just kind of curious as to kind of where your thoughts are on the future of Kenpo and where you'd like it to go.
Yeah, it's you know, since Mr. Parker's passing, you know, it's been fragmented, but I kind of see at this point with the different generations coming up behind us, a need for, you know, that camaraderie to get back into a little bit more, you know, let's share what was shared with us and get out there and have a common thread like we used to have. And that was just, you know, let's just get on the mat and work out. Let's get out and share, you know, like I said, what was shared with us. And then have a good attitude with the thing. I think the last probably 5-6 years for me, I've seen that more and more. And so I've opened up to it, where before I just thought, you know, I'm off doing my thing. And I was happy just to do that. But, you know, I've been asked to get out outside my group, like I said, the last 5 or 6 years, even more so. I've done it a few times, but, you know, a limited time on my side prevents more of it. But I committed to 2026 to get out there 4 or 5 times more outside my group than I have in the past. And so, and there's a lot of great talent out there. Both some of these young generations coming up are just, you know, their mindset is really a lot like yours, where they, you know, they get hooked into two or three or four different styles or systems of martial arts, trying to make themselves more well-rounded, which I think is a great investment in yourself. You know, so I see even more of my group, we've been doing, I'll call it mixed martial arts, as they do today, but we were doing jujitsu back, you know, in 1991, and we were doing continual fighting in my schools since the 80s. And it wasn't just the point fighting, but it was continual fighting. And, you know, we did some groundwork, like I said, but it wasn't so much of the jujitsu as they call it today. But we did do the groundwork. And then in the 90s, when it got more prevalent, you know, we adapted that. You know, we didn't take anything and leave out of Kenpo or the other stuff that we were doing, but we certainly added to jujitsu, and we still do today. Very prevalent in all our schools.
Gotcha. Now, so what is your thought on cross training, and have you yourself trained in any other arts, or is it just all Kenpo all the time?
Well, I did explore through friends that they became really good friends, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, and especially the 80s. Did some cross training in Kaju Kenpo, and there's a lot of similarities and such there. Did a little bit of stick stuff and some knife work as well. But mine has been primarily Kenpo. And then, like I said, then we got into the jujitsu. We have several of our black belts, top black belts, that do a lot of cross training, and they bring it back and they share it. And that's part of the deal. They come in and they ask, you know, what do you think? You know, is it okay if I go out and study with so-and-so? And I said, yeah, there's only one, you know, one thing you have to remember, that if you go out there and you do that, you know, don't forget who you're representing, not just, you know, myself, but yourself, you know, and you represent yourself in a good way, but you have to come back and share that information with us and give credit where credit is due.
So over the years, what kind of, how has your teaching style changed? Are there things that, things that you do now that maybe wish were around when you were coming up, or the things that that you did before coming up that that you wish that we as Kenpoists would do now?
But the thing that's really changed me over the years, and my guys always tease me about it, is that, you know, if I taught today like I taught back then, I probably wouldn't have very many students. And that was, the take was, you know, you did it this way because that's the way I told you to do it. Not that I asked you to do it. You know, that was part of the regimen. And if you want to be part of the group, you just did it. If you had questions, keep them to yourself. They'll tell you the questions you could ask. You know, as that progressed and we got smarter with that teaching, you know, it's better to, how do I put this? It's better to ask a certain way rather than tell them a certain way, and you get a better response. If you inform them of, you know, why we're doing it a specific way and the benefits of that, it comes out a little bit nicer, but the rewards are even greater, I think. They accept it. The people are, I think, smarter today than we were back then, because we just didn't ask questions. They said no, and that's just the way it was. But today, you know, the training's smarter. You know, the science and the training is much, much more advanced. And so with that, you know, you get out there and you share, like I said, a reason why we're doing it a particular way. It's easily more absorbed and accepted.
Yeah, true. So what would be, so for me, I'm, it's kind of a long story as far as, with my instructor and in my school and everything, but, we'll just to keep it brief and getting into the instructor side, myself, I, I ran a capoeira group for a lot of years, so I'm not completely new to teaching. But on the Kempo side of it, I guess we could say I'm still a newbie at it. So, what would be maybe a few things that you would give as advice for building a good instructor? You know, how would you go about constructing a good instructor and
But when I go out and teach now, you know, I have a plan. You know, I make a plan, come up with a topic, you know, make sure I do my research on my own material and be prepared for questions. I always ask people, you know, to come prepared with questions. If questions pop up on the moment, please ask, and because it's shared with everybody, not just one person in the class, but everybody should benefit from that. And so I was recently in Cheyenne, Wyoming, teaching at one of our schools there, and some great questions came up that I hadn't heard for decades, or nobody has brought up for decades. And I started sharing this information that was in the back of my head, stored there somewhere, but it just hadn't come out in decades. And several of my top black belts were in the class, and they said, "You've never told us, you've never shared this with us before." And I, you know, it's just my Mr. Parker came out, and I just said, "Well, you never asked me before." So, you know, I don't know how any other way to put it other than, you know, there's a lot of stuff back there, and a lot of people say they forgot more than they remember today. And sometimes that's true, but, you know, the Kempo has so much information that you can't, you know, put it in writing and say, we're going to start here and then go from one to two to three or from A to B to C and to try to learn the system. You have to get out there and have to be involved. You were recently at one of my seminars. It was great to have you out there and to finally meet you. And you had some good questions, but there was other people in that group that had some good questions. And what I try to do is break it down. And what I've learned is if I break it down in numbers rather than calling it a whole bunch of different names that some people may not be familiar with, but if I break it down in numbers and categorize it that way, it seems to be absorbed a little bit quicker and it gets internalized a little bit more as well.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I enjoyed about the seminars, that, you know, we were kind of mixing in. We're encouraged to kind of play with the techniques and you know, modify them and tweak them a little bit and experiment with them. It's real easy to just kind of go down the list and, okay, well, now we're doing thundering hammers, and you do, you know, step one, two, three. But to have that opportunity to go, oh, well, you know, instead of doing this move, let's add this to it, or let's add this wrist lock to it, or this arm bar to it, and just really kind of mold those movements to the individual, because just like every Kempo person out there, there are techniques that I'm not a fan of. There are techniques that I love. There are techniques that I think like why in the world are we doing this? And then there are techniques that you know some don't do, and it's like, well, why. But these techniques were really good. Why were they taken out? So being encouraged to experiment and explore, you know, what makes up all of this art is really, really a good thing in my view to do.
And that's what really captured me as I got more advanced and got more private lessons with Mr. Parker. Is, you know, we would talk about the intellectual part of it. You know, the movement part was already had a great foundation and a good base from where I came from. And so in order to enhance that, he would explain it further of why we did a technique this way. It's not necessarily, the techniques aren't necessarily meant to say, I can go from one to five in the series of this movement and make it work in its entirety. That's not the point. The point is to show or to demonstrate, you know, a theory or a concept within the motion or the movements. And then so if you had four basic movements, in theory, you should be able to come up with 24 different combinations. And so you sit there and you do the math and you're going, holy cow. You know, how do I do this? And so it really gets you thinking. And so when I break down the yellow, say the yellow belt techniques, yellow belt techniques are actually one large technique put together individually. So that we have 10 of them, but there's this series of motions and movements all depending on application. I think we talked about that when I was out there. What's the application of the movement? You know, is it an inward block or an inward hammer fist? You know, targeting. And so when you break it down that way, you know, so it's to teach you what Mr. Parker called variables. If you looked at, and we talked about that as well, I believe, you know, I do a lot more of the what he called variable expansions. I might take a base technique and then we just kind of expand on it and see how far we can go with it. And it's all based on where you are in a position on someone that you're defending against. And he called it position recognition. You know, what are my opportunities here? And given the basics, depending on the level that you are, given the basics, you should have an answer for that. So if he comes in with the left, are you on the inside or the outside, on the right side or the left side? You know, is his left foot forward with the front hand, or is his left foot forward striking with the backhand? So just recognizing where you are and the position and the opportunities that you have to respond. And I think at yellow belt, that they have all the answers. I remember being in teaching a clinic out here in Idaho before I moved out here. A person challenged me on that, and it wasn't so much he was being disrespectful, but he was questioning the idea of just that. You know, he said, well, there's just so many different combinations. There's so many different this. And I just said, there's really only 10 techniques that make up this whole system. Everything else is redundant. And it's just based on what I just mentioned just beforehand. And so, but that's all that makes up the system. Everything other than that is application and understanding where you are on the body. So that intrigues me. That's what makes it fun for me to go out and still teach and challenge students out there to recognize that on their own. And it's kind of fun for me when I get out there and teach it. I will always say, I'll teach you A-way and never say it's D-way. Because D-way to me is the one that works in the street. And so, and if you can't understand that, you need to get back on the mat, keep working until you understand it. If you're entitled to, that's not everybody wants to do it that way. You know, they want you to give them the answer. Well, like I said, the correct answer is the one that works in the street. And how are you going to learn that unless you get on the mat and put some hours in?
Yeah, I like that. And I totally agree with that is that there isn't one way for anything. And like I mentioned, there are techniques that for someone like me just don't really fit. And there are techniques that I think fit me very well. And those same techniques won't fit for someone else. And kind of goes in those different ways for the person. So, being able to find the way that works for the individual is one of the things that I love about Kenpo. So.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, some of the not so, you know, favorite techniques that are out there, you know, but what are they trying to teach you in motion? That's a big question, you know, so a lot of that is misunderstood. And so, you know, so challenge yourself, and I suggest that to anybody listening, you know, challenge yourself to understand and go back and research why is this technique taught a particular way. A lot of it is to teach, you know, a logical sequential order of flow, which is very basic in Kenpo. Can you rearrange it? Absolutely. We know that. But understand why it's done a particular way, because it's going to teach you, like I said, a principle or a concept. Not that it's going to make a difference in the street from beginning to end, but you could take a middle of a technique and go, you know, to the end of it or rearrange it. And would it work? You don't know until you try it. You start practicing and figure out what combinations work best for you.
And so you're given all these options, you know, just like the alphabet. You know, how often do you use all those letters in the alphabet on a daily basis?
Exactly.
Not always. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, not always, but you need, you know, there, you know, the knowledge is there when you need it, hopefully.
Gotcha. So that kind of leads into the I guess the flip side of the teacher question and what items would you say you need to have or what advice would you give to building a good student?
First you have to have a student that's interested in, you know, first of all, coming in. And just, you know, just like my friend, you know, he was interested in starting, but not interested in following up. For me, I wasn't interested in starting, but once I started seeing what it had to offer, you know, it intrigued me. And so every time I came to a class, I came prepared. I came prepared not only just to ask a question or two, but to do the physical workout. You know, it was going to benefit me. All the stuff I did in the early years was all about me. It wasn't about anybody else. Nobody else cared. Nobody else knew I was doing this except for my friend Mike. And so the investment, I looked at it, it was in me. And, you know, and I tell people that when I go out, even today, you know, is there a better investment? And I would think not. And so with that, you know, you're investing in something very, very private, very personal, but very valuable. You know, the one time you may need it, it's either to defend yourself or to help somebody else, or just have the physical ability just to get the heck out of it and get to safety. And it's all valuable information.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. I agree with that. I'm trying to think of the guest, but there was a guest that I had some time ago that mentioned something that I hadn't really thought of, but they mentioned that now we're getting further and further away from those that knew Ed Parker, that trained with Ed Parker, were just kind of getting away from the knowledge of Ed Parker. So I would want to ask, maybe what is some kind of key things in your mind that you would want to put out that we should have to, I'm not really sure how I want to word this. Not so much maybe keep his legacy alive, but maybe just still have that kind of a connection to him, because you know we're unfortunately, you know, we're losing the OGs and those that have been around. So maybe what are some things that you'd kind of want to put out there that we make sure that we hold on to?
Yeah, I try to encourage people to get out and participate in some of these seminars with some of the first and second generation black belts that got to study directly with Mr. Parker, not just in seminars, but, you know, privately as well, because he gave a lot of information out to different people. You know, what he may have shared with me, he probably didn't share with somebody else and vice versa. You know, and he was only one man. He can only get so much information out, you know. Although in his short lifetime, he certainly did get a lot of information out, a lot of written material. But a lot of it gets misinterpreted, I think, because they don't have a direct connection to either with him at the time or one of his, you know, direct students. And I think a lot of it gets lost in interpretation. And so the more you can get out there and participate with some of these people, the more you're going to observe. So what gets really lost in the translation that I have seen is that, what did he mean at the levels that he taught? Now you can get into the forums, and as a black belt, you can say, well, why didn't he do this? Why didn't he do that? You know, why didn't he show this at that time? Why didn't he show that at this time? Because at the level that he wanted it taught at, they weren't prepared. They weren't ready to accept that. You don't take somebody as a beginner, even 1 year in, and start teaching them calculus. It doesn't work. You've got to start at the base. That's why you come up with the concept, you know, alpha, beta motion. Then you get into the ring arrangement numerical concept. One of the things that I don't know that many people tap into is a lot of people, you know, would argue, well, he started off with 40 techniques, then he went to 32, then he went to 24, and then towards the end of his life, he accepted the 16. But what's the common denominator in those numbers? Do you know? That's a question for you.
That's a good one. I feel like this has come up before, and I'm blanking on the answer. So I need to do my homework.
See, but that's the point. In saying people don't recognize what it is. How does a computer count?
Oh yeah,
it's in binary.
Yeah,
what's binary? 8. So if you look at all those numbers and how he broke it down, it went from 40 to 32 to 24 to 16. It's all in eights. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And so, I mean, he was just so way ahead of his time. And so when you sit there and you listen to him and your head cocks a little bit, the eyebrows come up, you start thinking a little bit differently of why he set the system up the way he did. Now, a lot of people have eliminated some of the techniques, whether they're losing, or this is just my opinion, they're losing what he was trying to give them. So he put the techniques in order to help you realize at some point, and you don't get it right away, but it's the word I'm looking for right now. They're put in such a way that's, you know, subliminally, he implanted something there, and then once you start recognizing what he did there, you're sitting there going, oh boy, didn't get that. It could have been 5 years down the road. I still teach today, and questions come up, and I start talking and start spewing stuff that's, you know, that was back there for, like I said, for decades maybe, and it just hits me. I'm like, oh my goodness, that's what he meant. It's still finding, I mean, still pops up in me, and so I'm still learning and still trying to grasp what he meant at the levels that he was teaching at. Have you read his Infinite Insights 1 through 5? You'll recognize it every time you go back and you read or reread that you're going to get something different that you didn't catch the first go around. It's interesting how I've caught that he and I asked him this one time. I said, how many different levels do you write on? And he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, because every time I go back and I reread, or I pick a chapter or pick a topic within those books that I'm going to go out and share, that I grab something that I didn't catch before. And it just, you know, and to me, I just wasn't ready to accept it or ready to see it or hear it. And then all of a sudden, one day, it just clicks. And so that's what's unique about this system as well. And that's why I encourage people to go out and get with some of these seniors. You know, you don't have to be part of their organization. They'll invite you in. They'll accept you. You know, some are great communicators. You know, some not so much, but you're going to get something out of it that you didn't have before. And that's where I think the younger generation needs to get out there and get with some of these people. Like I said, you know, we're not going to be around forever. And so, you know, like with me, my guys hound me all the time. I get emails and I get phone calls and, you know, when you're coming back out, or can we get a Zoom? And a lot of our, especially with the advanced belts now, is a lot of it is the whole lesson. It could be an hour, it could be 2 hours. They've captured me for 4 hours in a group. And all we do is we talk about the motion and why he did it this way, or why didn't he put what was in long four in long three, or in short two, or, you know, long two, because we weren't ready for it. The stepping stones weren't there. They were just starting at the lower belt levels and working themselves up.
Gotcha. That something with that just made me think, and I think I may have to start asking this to definitely any of my senior guests, but just in general. So there's, and of course they're going out of my mind at the moment, but there are three techniques that were, I guess, pulled out of the system that kind of. I scratch my head because it seems like everyone that I talk to, that, is familiar with these techniques, they're all fans of them, and I can't understand why they were pulled out of the system. And wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, some of them, this is, I've had that conversation with Mr. Parker, but some of it was that the concept or the theory or the principle he was trying to teach was redundant in other places. And so, that's the best answer he gave me. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, but still the motion of the movement is so, so elementary, and you can, sophisticate it very easily, and you can see where it came from and where it went to. And so, with some of those, some of us put those back in the system, not so much as in the curriculum as we do maybe teaching in a group class or going out and teaching a seminar and bringing the motion or the movement up. One of the things that's you probably caught with me is that I'll use some names of the techniques to relate to the motion and the movement, but most of the time it's all about the motion or the movement with me. I go back to, is it on the inside or the outside, on the right side or the left side? And it's always in pairs. And so I try to break it down that way and try to bring those, there's probably three or four techniques that he dropped out that I still like to bring up, especially to the beginners classes or and the kids classes in particular. So the motion or movement won't be forgotten, but I don't know how many other people do that.
Yeah, I've been kind of surprised. That's the thing that I scratch my head about is that there are a lot of instructors that still teach those techniques, and it's like, well, everyone likes these techniques. Why are they, if they I guess a response that I've heard a number of times was that the techniques were I guess too complicated or too advanced for a yellow belt. And I think, and I always just think, well, then let's move them to a different, a different belt or
Yeah.
somewhere else in the system
Well,
instead of pulling them out. But
the same reasoning is why some people have pulled some of the techniques out of the system on a larger scale. They just say, well, these won't work. Well, then they don't understand what they were intended to teach. That's, you can take a lot of these techniques and say that wouldn't work in the street. Yeah, but how about individual motion or movement within that number technique? Would that work? Well, yeah, well, why didn't they do that? Well, it's looking at different angles, angles, different angles of entry, different angles of incidents that might be, where you are when you start. And so it's just to get you familiar with where you are on the body, like I mentioned earlier, position recognition. But to me, to take a lot of these techniques out in large numbers is, I don't think that they're understanding what he intended them to be like. I can see the two or three or four that were dropped out, and some of those were unintentional. All right. And I think he got talked into some of that stuff. But I know when he came to my schools and, were asked about those techniques, oh, he was happy to get on to them and spend a whole hour, 2 hours talking about just two techniques and breaking them down. Not too many people do that anymore.
yeah, no, I like that. So I like breaking things down and really getting into you know, what makes these techniques, what makes these movements tick. So in my training, the school that I started at, it was essentially the Tracy's curriculum. So we had 40 techniques per belt. And while I enjoyed that, that's a lot of information to get. And in the school I'm at now, we're on the 16 technique curriculum. And I like that because we get more time and we get more deep into working each technique and get a better understanding of the concepts. I mean, school, but, you know, we did a lot of air karate and we did a lot of stuff that, because there was so much material to get through, we didn't really get to dig into a lot of those things. So,
you see, and that's exactly what Mr. Parker said. You know, you get to spend more time on it. In reality, you get all the base moves and all that they have to offer through black belt. And so when he started looking at that and realizing, yes, we're getting, you know, less is actually getting you more, that's why he had changed and was doing the 16. Now, not everybody agrees that he said that, but I have seen handwritten letters. I gotten phone calls from him asking my opinion. And quick story on that is that he'd call up sometimes 6:30 in the morning. He had a brainstorm that he was working on. He'd ask my opinion. And unbeknownst to me, other people were saying the same thing that I was saying. And then a conversation one time, I was teaching at Brian Duffy's camp near Austin. And I brought it to him. I said, has the old man ever brought up to you about, you know, changing the order of the techniques a little bit and then, but bringing them down to 16? And he just started chuckling. And he says, yeah, I'm going to show you something tomorrow. Handwritten letters between him, Mr. Parker, and Brian Duffy. Brian came up with the idea and sold it to Mr. Parker. And Mr. Parker was fielding a number of his black belts on what they thought about it. Some of the older guys were saying,
sorry about that.
That's okay.
My phone went off of Do Not Disturb and I went to go turn it back on and then I hit
Oh, got it.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Well, I get back to my story about Brian Duffy. Well, anyway, we wound up being on the same page as well as some of the others. Some of the really older guys, you know, didn't want to change. But then we go back and you say, okay, what is the original number that was taught when Ed Parker started teaching? Do you know that number?
No, I don't.
10. And the name of the techniques were number 1, number 2, number 3, and so forth, right through 10. Now they had... the only thing that defined them besides that was the attack. I remember teaching that at Tracy's art place. I won't tell you the person because he's still around, but he talked me, and it took him 2 years to talk me into teaching at his event. And I said, I'll teach under one condition. You know, there's no controversy, no political thing going on. Perfect. So after 2 years of going back and forth, I went there and I taught with five others, I think. And it was really the way he set it up because it was generational. It started with Matosi lineage and then it went, you know, to all the way through Ed Parker, but it went through the lineage, you know, going through, you know, the Kaju Kempo days and stuff like that with that group, but all the way up through current, which was Ed Parker. And the way he laid it out was, that's who taught, you know, from 1 to 2 to 3, and I was the last person up. And then one of the Tracy guys said, well, you know, Ed Parker's always changing stuff. And I says, no, he's always evolving some of the stuff. He says, well, we still teach the original. I said, nobody still teaches the original except for some of the super, super, super old guys, maybe back in the islands. He says, no, we teach the original stuff. I says, nobody teaches original stuff. So we got a little chat about that. And I said, okay, let me ask you this. I said, ever see on Facebook or on YouTube in particular, there's a scroll out there on 8mm, and there's an easel with a big sheets of paper, and it has technique number one, technique number two. How many have seen all those? About 95% of the hands went up in that class. And I bet there was probably 50, 60 people in that class. I said, those are the originals. How many are teaching those today? And only those. Nobody's hand went up. And I said, yeah, right. None of us do. None of us do. I guess because we've all progressed at some point or some level. I said, but then, you know, you can get analysis paralysis, when Ed Parker sings. I said, and to me, that's where, you know, when you have so many techniques for a belt level, it doesn't get internalized. It doesn't get absorbed. One of the things that I learned years ago when I took a psychology class in college is that the brain can only absorb so much at any given time. It's like a sponge. Once a sponge gets too much liquid or fluid into it, what happens? It just runs out.
Yeah, exactly.
And so,
exactly.
Yeah, so that's always stuck with me. So I agree with your analogy, you know, to where, to me, at this point, less is more, but not to the point where you cut a big section of these techniques out of the system and call it progressive. You know, no, you replaced it with something else, either groundwork or, you know, a stick work or whatever you want to, you know, call what you're doing with the thing, but you've taken it out. And so in that sense, you are losing some legacy there. So, but like I said, you know, that's my opinion. That's based on what I see and what I hear that's out there.
No, I like it. I like it. one of the things that I love about Kenpo is that it does have the names for techniques and everything. So in my training, I'm so used to the technique names, and in Hapkido, at the Hapkido school that I train at, we our self defense techniques is, you know, yellow belts one, yellow belt two, yellow belt three,
right.
And it gets really confusing. And then in between the belts, it's like for like yellow belts, you'll get one set, one through five, and then you'll get another set, one to three. And then when you get to orange belts, then it starts four through nine. And then when you go to another, it's very confusing to me. It's like, I want, you know, thundering hammers. Orange five doesn't do it for me. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one of the unique things that Kenpo has done. They've given them names related to the motion or the movements that they're trying to teach. So, but what's interesting, I've seen some of the jiu-jitsu charts now are being categorized very similarly, which I think is brilliant, because there's so much to the jiu-jitsu, as you know, that, you know, how do you remember all that stuff? Like you said, you know, orange five or blue 10 or whatever it might be. You know, they're starting to categorize their motion and their movement. And so I think that's brilliant as well.
Very nice. Very nice. The other thing, the other story that I like to tell is that some of my classmates, they're so much to learn, and how can I keep it all together? And it's like, wait a second, I started with 40 techniques each belt, and so 16 is a lot easier. Granted, we do more with like freestyle and basics and terminology and all of that stuff that we didn't do at my original school, but still, going to 40-16 isn't so bad.
Well, the other part is, you know, how is it presented? You know, I know some people that are just so super good, but when they go in and they teach, you know, they'll teach a 1.5, 2 hour class, and they'll throw as much information out there as they can. They go as hard and as fast as they can. It's like, wait a minute, can we review that? We'll get it next time. It's like, whoa, you know, I'm happy with taking two or three of these things and breaking them down and working them. So you get them internalized. And so one of the things that I do when I teach, I just had a workshop here with my advanced black belts. You know, I had to be fifth and above. and had to be qualified to get in. And we broke down an advanced form into quarters. So this time around, we spent 6 hours on just one quarter of this form. It's, you know, they're labeled like the techniques, like in a form, as you know, in Kempo, you know, that they'll have a name. You do it on one side and you do it on the other side, but it's labeled 1, 2, 3, and 4 as we label the techniques with their names. We went through 1 through 4 and barely got through them in 6 hours. And that's breaking them down. So can we film? No, we can't film. Well, I can't video. I said, no. When you go home, you video. Otherwise, you're slowing this class down. And so they've got to remember. But I give them just enough information where they have to stay focused. And they have to be informed of why we're doing it that way. And then they have to give it back to me. And so, you know, and so they were happy that it, we do it that way, because when they left here, there wasn't very many questions other than they took a lot of notes. But, you know, that's just me trying to hold them accountable for what I'm giving them. And so, you know, that method works. You know, that method works. I share one story with you here real quick. I was teaching in Milford, Massachusetts, a kids class. And there was a little over 30 kids in this class, and I had 1 hour to teach. And so I teach this form. It's called universal form. And it came out of the Midwest, I think, or back east from one of the black belts out there that developed it for kids. But it works well with adults, and it works well with special needs students as well. And so it has 16 counts. I break it down into 16 counts. So when I teach it, I'll teach 1, 1, 1, 1, and we just keep reviewing that one like it was a basic warm-up class. Then I'll go to 2, 2, 2. Then I'll put the 1 and 2 together. Then I'll leave 1 and 2 alone, and I'll go to step 3, and then we practice 3, 3, 3. Eventually, I'll put 1, 2, and 3 together. And then my game to me is I need to get everybody through this thing in 45 minutes, and not everybody learns the same. As we know. And so I had a couple of these kids in there, one kid in particular that had Asperger's and was way in the back. By the time I finished with this kid, he was standing at the front because that's where he wanted to be. Where in the past, his parent says, no, he won't come up to the front. I said, okay, but I challenged him. And a lot of it was, you know, I put the mitts up there and he had to touch left hand to my left hand, right hand to my right hand, some of the motions. And by the time I finished, he had all 16 counts as well as everybody else. But I always have a little game that I play with the kids, and I call it mandatory fun. Everybody's got to come up and show me what they learned in the class today. And so I asked for a volunteer to come up and do the form that we just learned. He was the first one that raised his hand. The only thing I had to help him with, he asked me if I could count the moves for him. And that's where I go back earlier when I mentioned I do it by numbers. Not so much by, you know, outward back knuckle or inward block, right punch. You know, I do it by the numbers. And he got them all except for 2 areas. And I went back and how I taught it. He got stuck on 4 and 5. So I went back and went 1, 2, 3. We practiced 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And all of a sudden I just said 4. And he looked at me and, you know, maybe a 2-second hesitation, and he got 4. So I picked up and I went 5, 6, and he got stuck on 9 and 10. So I did the same thing. I went back to 7, 8, 9, 7, 8, 9. And he picked up 9 and went right to 10. So it's just interesting how you play with these. And you learn as an instructor the different methods that, you know, they just sometimes they just pop in my head. And sometimes I go watch other instructors teach and learn from them as well. So that's challenging for me, but it's fun for me. That's what keeps me involved.
I like it. That's good. All right. So as it happens with every guest, there's so many things that I want to cover, but you know, we can't have a 20-hour show. So we're going to move into our lightning round here. Got a few little questions as we wrap up. So the first question being, do you have a favorite technique?
a favorite technique. I have a favorite opening.
Okay, I'll take it.
I call it self offense. And so I like to, part of my, mine is, I like to, I'm right-handed, but I fight left-handed, and I'll use my right side forward. And so my reaction would be, if somebody came in with one way or the other, they said, like, if you put your right arm up and say, hey, and try to protect yourself, we call that either an extended outward block or an upward block. And then response would be just a quick one, too, like block out, strike in, and then pick it up from there. Because that's a quick response, and it's a natural response.
Very nice. Very nice. I like it. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
My favorite set is actually blocking set one.
Nice.
Because it gives all the element. It gives all the elements of what we need all the way through long form eight. And then sometimes when I was just recently teaching long form six as a review to one of the advanced black belts. And they get stuck in a couple of, it's very similar to many others. They get stuck in a particular area of long form six. And I go back to, so do the first move in long, or blocking set one. And I said, so I have them go through it, both sides. And I said, you see anything familiar there? And they went, some of them say, yes. They sit there and just slap themselves on the head and said, oh my God, I should have caught that a long time ago. I said, well, now you're ready to accept it. Now you're going to see it all over the place. And it's the same thing when I teach long form seven. Not everybody does that form, but it's the same thing. You know, blocking set gives you so much in theory, or the concepts of what he's supposed to be teaching, in just natural motion or movement. And so, and then my favorite form used to be long four, because it teaches everything that Kempo has to offer. But long five became a favorite of mine, probably in the 80s, when everybody was performing at the Long Beach Internationals and doing well with it. They'd do either four or six, and everybody, you know, you get somebody in the black belt category that has 70 plus participants, and that gets kind of old. I wound up doing long form five because it's obscure, and it teaches opposites and reverses, obviously, and takedowns. And so I got up there, and I was the first one of 73 competing that day. And I held on to first place until I dropped down to third place, right at the last three. And so, but that was my biggest achievement at the internationals for that I felt anyway. That was, my finest memory of competing with forms there. But long form five, I like because it's obscure.
Very nice. I like it. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite weapon?
I like,
besides yourself.
Yes, I like, yeah, right. I don't know about that. I really, really like the sticks. Not a lot of people, like the sticks, but so I like the Kempo sticks in particular, not the long, you know, Screamer Cali sticks, but the, you know, the shorter ones, you know, conforming to our size in Kempo. I recently taught, like I said, in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and I decided to do techniques out of form seven. And these guys have had form seven for a long time, but when you break them down on the body and start showing them the mechanics, and here again, coming back to blocking set one, the mechanics of that, and they're sitting there going, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't see this before. But then it's being able to translate it from understanding it into the motion is the challenge, as we know. So, and the other one I really, really enjoy is the knives. I got to play with Mr. Parker with those, and it's quite interesting. My best advice, and he says the same thing, and everybody that I know that is familiar with knives outside of just learning the art of them, is that you see a knife, do a 180 and run as fast as you can. It's just inherent that, you know, you're going to get cut if you play with them, and that's not a place to be.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think I talked with one of my previous guests. Well, I know I brought it up with a few of my guests, so I have some training knives, like a training karambit and things like that. And even though it's not sharp, but it does still have a point on it, and my wrists are real little beat up from twirling that thing around. But
they're fun. They're fun to play with and study the art of the knife or the blade.
Yeah, I agree. All right, I got two more questions here, and then we'll wrap it up here. The next one: if there's anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, who would that be? This is Kempo's show, so I had to take Ed Parker off the table.
Yeah, there is actually one that I really wish I could have gotten more of, and that's Danny Inosantos, because he's so well-versed. You know, he's a Kempo guy. Yes, he was a Kempo guy, black belt in Kempo, but his diversity in weapons and just knowledge and how he teaches and, you know, his teaching and such like that. Yeah, you know, he's a great one to me.
Very nice. Okay, and then the last question, what is something that inspires you to train? So I frame this question using this example. So anytime I watch the movie Rocky IV and there's the training montage, he's in the snow, he's chopping the wood, he's running through the snow, and the song is playing, and so I get hyped up every single time I see that scene, and I'm ready to, you know, hit the mats and get out there and train. So what is something that never fails to inspire you to get out there and train?
Actually, it's kind of personal, but being asked to go out and teach, and like I said, sharing earlier what was shared with me, I get inspired by the look on some of the students' faces, the questions that come up, you know, and you give them something, how hard they try, you know, and how hard they work. That inspires me. Then you hold them accountable for it. I'll just share one last story with you. Again, teaching in Austin at one of Brian Duffy's camps. It was all adults at this particular camp, so no kids. But one of the guys had to bring his son with him because he had custody of him that weekend. And the boy was a blue belt and maybe 12 years old at the time. And so they asked if, you know, he can just jump into class and just be in the back and just, you know, kick and do whatever, and he'd be happy. And I said, oh, absolutely. Just let him come in. And so, but this kid caught me because he was just so captivated by what I was saying, you know, and I just, for whatever reason. And so he kept asking me this question. So I said, I'm going to make sure he gets through this movement, you know, and he runs here again. I was doing these variables. And I said, okay, now you understand that? And he goes, yes. I said, let me see you walk through it one time for me. And so he did. And I said, okay, I want you to go over there and practice it. When you think you got it, I said, you come back to me. I said, and we're going to review it real quick. Yes, sir. He runs off over there. And I kept my eye on him. He would just practice it and going it, you know, and he kept having to redo it and getting stuck. But he kept going back at it. And all of a sudden he hits it. And he didn't know I was watching. All of a sudden, he looked up and he looked around like, at least like, yes, I got it. But he's looking to see if I was watching him, and I was watching him. And that just inspired the heck out of me. And just from that alone has kept me, you know, to where I'm doing this still today. That kid was so inspiring.
Very nice. Yeah, I know that look. So I can agree with you on that one. I've given it.
I think we've all experienced that, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was so fun.
Very nice. I like it. All right. So the very last thing that we have today, and, you know, like I say, with all of my guests, we'll definitely have to do a part 2 and 3 and 4 and 12. But the last thing for today is it's now time for shameless self-promotion. So you can plug anything you want, or if there's anything that you wanted to get out there that maybe we didn't cover today, now's your chance. You have the floor, and then we'll close out from there.
Very simple for me. Get out there and invest in yourself. Go out there to as many of these seminars or clinics that you can afford to get out to, or that would grab your interest. Get out there and explore. Go find out what you like and not tell them or have somebody tell you, you know, what you can or can't do. The investment is in yourself. Get out there and invest.
I like it. Very well said. Very well said. All right. Well, I thank you so much for taking the time to be on and sharing your insights with me and the listeners. I'm excited to finally get a chance to sit down with you. I know we had some struggles, but that's okay. We got it worked out. And I can't thank you enough for being on, and I look forward to getting this out for everyone to hear, and hopefully we can do this again at another time.
All right, thanks for having me, Reggie. Hopefully we'll see you out there.
All right, will do. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.